Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC. Now on to the details of the congestion pricing tolls that got finalized by the part of the MTA that was working on that this week. As I mentioned yesterday, there are still some court cases challenging the whole concept, and we'll see if any of those actually derail the plan. But the final rules for congestion pricing are out officially, and they're supposed to take effect in June. So let's talk to our transportation reporter, your friendly neighborhood transportation reporter, as he goes on Twitter or X, Stephen Nesson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Brian.
And are you surprised that our lines are already full before you've even spoken one word with people with questions and comments about that? Is this consistent with your experience as a reporter this week?
Oh, 100%. And just illustrative of that, Brian, real quick. When I went out to talk to drivers after the vote, I just walked up to one driver and I didn't even have to ask a question. He just unprompted said, congestion pricing. I hate it.
And I see there are like 500 comments on your Gothamist article. And I don't know how often that happens, but not very often. All right. Rule number one, congestion pricing $15 for passenger cars in effect from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. on weekdays. Starts a little later in the morning on the weekends, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. And I wonder even about that, John, even on Saturdays and Sundays, up till 9 o'clock at night, people have to pay this congestion pricing fee. Why'd they do that?
Well, the analysis found that, if you want to reduce congestion in the city, essentially there's congestion all the time in Manhattan. After the pandemic, subway ridership, still hasn't returned to the pre-pandemic levels, but traffic levels are above where they were before the pandemic. Over 100%, of the traffic is back. So this is really, an effort to address that and deal with that and unclog, the streets of Manhattan.
And I know I just called you John. I was still locked into the last segment with our colleague, John Campbell. So, Stephen, you want to start going down the list of exemptions?
Sure. Really, Brian, there are very, very, very few exemptions. And the reason for that is that the more exemptions you create, or the more these exemptions the MTA creates, the higher the price would have to be. So they're trying to keep the price as low as possible, so they're not overburdening. Remember, there was a threat at one point that it was going to cost $24 to drive into Manhattan.
Yeah.
So as a result, there are very few exemptions. There were some that were baked into the law, and then some that the MTA the Traffic Mobility Review Board came up with. But of course, emergency vehicles are exempt. But this week we got sort of a tweak to the exemptions. They called it a clarification, but essentially school buses, which had not been originally exempt, will be exempt.
I just stop you on this one for a second? I mean, I couldn't even believe that this was a topic. School buses were going to be charged the congestion pricing fee?
Well, it's kind of a quixotic reason, I suppose, but for some reason, MTA folks got it into their head that school buses are often rented as party buses on off hours.
Oh.
But apparently the DOE was like, not our yellow school buses, maybe other buses.
Right. I guess they can't quickly code the toll readers so precisely that they can distinguish between school buses taking kids to school and school buses being used for party buses.
Right. So that was sorted. And another sort of sticking point for Mayor Adams, especially, was the city's municipal vehicles. Of course, fire trucks and garbage trucks are exempt, but it was not clear about sort of other vehicles that are sort of necessary for city jobs. Think of like road repair crews. And as the city said, even like an ACS worker that has to go investigate a case, they wanted those people who drive for work to be exempt. So about 5,000 different types of municipal vehicles are going to be exempt from the toll. And the MTA sat down with the city and went through, like, agency by agency, who absolutely has to drive for this job, and put together a list. I will note they did not release it publicly, but said we have to check open data at a later date to see which vehicles are exempt. So I'm looking forward to that deep dive.
And we should say, and I think they've talked about this from the beginning, that another exemption, if you want to call it an exemption, is you don't get tolled if you don't actually come off the highways on the perimeter of Manhattan onto the city streets. So I guess, like, this is so for through traffic, right? If you want to go from Brooklyn to New Jersey, you can come over the Williamsburg Bridge, go down the FDR Drive, around the Battery, up the West Side, and out the Holland Tunnel, and you're not going to get charged. Is that accurate?
That is the idea. That is the idea. But I need to double check and confirm whether, you know, there's any sort, you know, there are some little things to note. Like, if you drive on city streets, you're going to get charged. So it's not 100% clear to me that you wouldn't be charged trying to get into the Holland Tunnel.
And that's West Street down there at the perimeter. Right. It's not exactly the same as what we call the West Side Drive. It's really the Henry Hudson Parkway north of 57th Street, right? So you're not going to be told until you're off of that. Let's say you come in on the George Washington Bridge and you come down that Henry Hudson. Once you get off there at 57th Street onto the city streets, I guess that's where the toll kicks in.
That's right, below 60th Street.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, if you went through the Battery Park Tunnel and you stayed on the West Side Highway to that, you would not be charged, if that helps.
Right. So, all right. Well, we'll have to clear that one up yet. Meanwhile, Brooklynites, when this kicks in, I guess you'll have to go through Staten Island if you want to go to New Jersey and not pay a toll. But then there are other tolls. The 60th Street border for this, have they installed the infrastructure, the readers? These, I guess, would be easy pass readers and license plate readers. Is that right?
That's right. It should be completely done by now. They were just wrapping it up about a month ago, so I assume everything is finished now. And they're actually pretty cool, unique pieces of technology. You know, like the Easy Pass gantries that you see on the highways and stuff. Yep. This is a much, much smaller. I think for the most part, like, more than half of them were put on sort of existing pieces of infrastructure, like light posts or pedestrian crossways. And these things are supposedly, like, AI sort of, enabled so that they get smarter over time, but they can actually detect the size of the vehicle, because that's sort of key to the tolling, is that different vehicles are charged different rates. You know, personal vehicles are $15, like we said, but a small truck is $24 and a large truck is $36. So it sort of has a sensor that can tell when a vehicle enters this sort of reader zone and when it leaves, and apparently it's going to get smarter over time at doing that. I think the majority of New Yorkers at this point, I think it's like 95% use Easy Pass, so that's how you'll be told. But for those that don't, you know, there is, it has a license plate reader, and that will send you a bill.
So maybe the black market and ghost plates or like Arizona plates that are fake and that they'll never find you by reading. Maybe that black market just got more lucrative.
Well, that is the major concern. And I'm not sure if John Campbell got into it, but that, you know, there is some legislation pending that the governor is hoping to include in this year's budget that would increase the penalties for that sort of, scuffalism.
Interesting. As we talk about the new congestion pricing rules finalized this week for driving on Manhattan city streets below 60th Street, so really 60th and below, I guess would be technically accurate. 212-433-WNYC. If you have a question, 212-433-9692. John, a number of our callers are people who live inside the zone, so let's take one of those. Karen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thank you so much. I live in the 20s on the east side, and once a month I go up to Costco. I take the FDR Drive to 117th Street, where local people are given jobs. And I want to know what it's going to cost me, whether it's going to be just $15 because I took my car out, or it's going to be $30, or what?
Stephen, can you help?
Besides my $6 parking fee.
You don't get charged to leave the city, but you do get charged to enter the city or enter the congestion zone. So it'd be $15 for your trip to Costco.
Right, when you come home. So, Karen, for better or worse, that's the answer. Let's see. Helping to clear up any confusion over exactly where the northern border is. We have a question from Jane in Long Island City. Jane, you're on WNYC with our transportation reporter, Stephen Nesson. Hi, Jane.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Hi, my question is, if I'm coming from Long Island City, going on the upper roadway of the Queensboro Bridge, because the Queensboro Bridge is at 60th Street. So either taking it, if I take it from Manhattan, I enter on 57th, which is going to the upper roadway. Is that going to be a charge?
Stephen, is there an answer?
That is a question we've had because it does seem somewhat unfair, especially if you don't actually want to go into Manhattan but just want to get on the Queensboro Bridge. But my understanding is you would be charged. I think, you know, one thing to note is that this is not like it's not set in stone like forever. This is how it's going to be. The MTA can tweak the program, can adjust, you know, the tolling infrastructure. So my understanding for now is yes, but it's not set in stone. So if this is like an ongoing problem, I imagine the MTA could find some way to tweak it.
So this is so in the weeds, Jane. Go ahead, Jane.
So entering from Queens, I'm getting on the upper roadway. So I'm charged when I make that. When am I charged? Am I charged at the entrance of Queensboro South when you're going on the upper roadway? Is there going to be a reader there? And then because the upper roadway leaves you at 62nd. So in reality, you shouldn't get charged because you're getting off at 62nd Street.
Right. So it's like you wouldn't be charged at 62nd Street, but at 57th, you would be.
But I'm saying again, going on the Queensboro Bridge in Queens.
Yeah, you don't get charged until you cross 60th Street in Manhattan. But was part of your question there, Jane, also about leaving the city?
Leaving
Manhattan.
When you're leaving.
I shouldn't say the city. Leaving Manhattan for Queens. Go ahead.
If you're leaving Manhattan and you take the lower roadway, you enter right at 60th Street. But if you take the upper roadway, you have to go down 57th to get on the ramp.
Right.
To go to the bridge. So
let's say, and Jane, thank you, I'm going to move on, but really good questions. Yeah, so theoretically, I guess, if you're doing something on 65th Street, Stephen, and you want to go to Queens from there, and you get on, which is it again, the lower roadway, where you have to enter at 57th Street, then you have to cross the threshold, you know, for 20 seconds, depending on traffic, and pay the toll, right?
That we've asked about that, and that has been my understanding. But of course, like I was saying, you know, the MTA doesn't want to create unnecessary bottlenecks in certain places. Like if the upper roadway is suddenly jammed because everyone's avoiding the lower roadway, I think that would be something they would probably address.
All right, now we're going to get on to the topic of discounts for tolls you pay before you get to the congestion pricing district. On the way in, just to put a button on the last call about 60th Street there, is it accurate to say 60th Street or below, or is it accurate to say below 60th Street? You get the distinction? It's a one-block distinction.
I do. We've been saying 60th Street. We've been saying below 60th Street. I've seen NBC reports below 61st Street. I've seen Hellgate reports below 59th Street.
Right.
But 60th Street is sort of the threshold we've been using. On 60th Street, you will be charged.
All right. Now about those tolls that you pay on the way in and what happens in those cases when you get to 60th Street or thereabouts. Nancy in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Brian. You keep saying that things have been finalized, but it sounds like this is the weirdest, complicated game in the world. listening to you. I listened yesterday, and I didn't hear anything about taking the Lincoln Tunnel in, so I Googled it. And way down below, after all the various complicated guidelines, it said something about the Holland and Lincoln Tunnels. There would be a, I don't know, $5 fee or something to enter the city. Do you guys know anything about this?
Yes.
Stephen, you do, right?
I do. I have it right here. So, yes.
Oh, good.
drivers will get a $5 credit toward the toll if you enter from the Queens Midtown Tunnel, Hugh Carey, Holland, and your Lincoln Tunnel.
So you pay, instead of $15 to enter the city, you spend, in the Manhattan, you spend $10. Yeah,
that's correct.
My theory is, everybody who I lived in Manhattan for a while, everybody who lives in Manhattan just said, should be illegal to have a car. And that way, you know, it'd be a lot easier than what everybody's going through to figure this out.
Nancy, thank you, but that is a whole other show. Should it be legal to have a car in Manhattan? And I could hear the heads exploding of our Manhattan residents who, for various reasons, think, I have to have a car. And some of them do. So that's the Lincoln and Holland Tunnel. What about the George Washington Bridge?
Nope. There is no credit for that.
So
you would be charged that, and if you enter the zone, you would also pay the $15.
How do they rationalize the difference?
That's a good question. I think the sense is that, you know, it's not comparable. Like, they feel like, you know, and partly this is a deal that, you know, is supposed to appease New Jersey, which we know has not been appeased by this at all. But it's just the sense that those tunnels, you don't have a choice. Once you exit the tunnel, you're in the tolling zone. Uh-huh. Whereas the George Washington Bridge, you're not automatically entering Manhattan, per se.
Interesting. So I wonder if we're going to see effect on traffic patterns in Jersey, if people might start avoiding the bridge and going south to the Lincoln Tunnel, you know, depending on where, of course, in New Jersey they're coming from and how inconvenient that is. But I think that's another thing to keep our eyes on. Here's a question further to the school bus exemption. Oded in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Hello, Oded, if I'm saying your name right.
You are saying it correct. Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Stephen. Thank you for taking my call. I was calling specifically related to the carve-out that is stated for DOE-contracted school buses. I am a parent volunteer coordinator for a little over 150 families from Queens that go to a school on the Lower East Side, which is a New York City public school. It's a citywide school called Nest Plus M. And we do not get busing provided by the city. We have to pay for it ourselves to get children as young as 5 years old to school. And from what I'm seeing, we are not going to get an exemption for our yellow school buses to bring our kids for New York City public school. Can you confirm that?
Well, I would ask, is your yellow school bus like a DOE certified school bus?
Yes, it is. They're licensed and it looks like any other school bus. It's just we pay for it privately, considered a private bus, not a New York City DOE contracted bus. The city does not provide busing to people who live outside of the borough or greater than 5 miles from their school. That's the Office of Transportation policy. I disagree with it. When you have a $1.5 billion budget for busing and transportation, and you have school kids and you give them a Metro card, it's a little hard to get a 5-year-old to school by 8 a.m. if they're coming from Queens or Brooklyn or the Bronx or Staten Island.
I hear you. But if I understand you correct, Stephen, that school bus would be exempt.
My understanding, I'll definitely have to go back and look at the fine print, but I thought the language the MTA used was if it's a DOE licensed school bus, they would be exempt. So you might be off the hook there.
Oded, I hope that answers your question. I guess really you're going to have to ask your school or ask the bus company on that particular, but it sounds like if it's DOE contracted, probably exempt. How about Ubers and Lyfts versus yellow cabs, Stephen? They're different rules, right? Different extra charges that the passengers pay depending on which kind of taxi you're using?
That's right. Just and this was a very contentious issue, but right, yellow and green taxis will pay an extra $1.25, whereas Uber and Lyft will pay an extra $2.50. And in fact, the as you know, the Taxi Workers Alliance, who's been very fierce, led by Beta V. Desai, were sort of the only ones that did sort of a very vocal protest at the vote this week. They disrupted it and marched sort of around the room before police escorted them out. But they were calling for a total exemption for yellow cabs because they say, you know, it's already stacked against them. Uber and Lyft have so many advantages and their drivers have been suffering, as you know, as we've reported for so many years. But they did not get a final exemption. And as you know, they already pay a previous sort of the very first congestion surcharge, as well as another MTA tax. So they were saying it's already like $10 to enter a taxi before you've even gone anywhere, which with fees that go just to the MTA.
So half the, it's an incentive to take a yellow cab if you can. It's like a dollar and a quarter incentive to take a yellow cab if you can, as opposed right. to an Uber or a Lyft if you're going to cross into the zone. Oh, here's a caller we had yesterday with a question, and I'm going to let him back on. I think it's the same caller for another topic that we haven't covered yet. Jesse in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jesse. Was that you yesterday?
Yeah. Hi, Brian. I'm flattered I get to talk to you 2 days in a row. This is like a lifetime achievement. hi, Stephen. So I called yesterday because I'm a motorcyclist, and I drive a Vespa, and I drive it every day in the city. And I know other cities outside of New York, for example, London has a congestion pricing tax. But they recognize how in that city, motorcycles don't actually contribute to congestion, and they're exempt from being charged. I'm just wondering, is there going to be any negotiation eventually to recognize that motorcyclists do not contribute to the actual congestion of New York City traffic? And I just feel like it was just, there was a lack of nuance in recognizing that different vehicles contribute or don't contribute, and specifically motorcycles.
Too yeah. late to lobby, though, Jesse. The rules are out. But it's half price, well, $7.50, right?
That's right. It's $7.50 during the day, $1.75 at night. But I think Jesse's totally right. Like they do differentiate because big trucks pay $24, even bigger trucks $36. But the difference between a motorcycle and a car is pretty vast in the amount of space they take up and the amount of pollution they create. And you know, the MTA has also been clear, like I was mentioning before, like, I know we talk about this like it's set in stone, but like things can be changed over time. So, I mean, if you want to lobby this issue or present data to the MTA, I'm sure, you know, they would be, you know, they would consider it. They would look at it.
People with handicap plates or other ways to signify passengers or drivers with disabilities exempt to what degree?
They are exempt. Vehicles that transport people with a disability, if you have the license plate, they would be exempt. I believe taxis that transport people with a disability, like the accessorized, certainly, you know, would be exempt as well. So that was an early exemption. As
accessorized,
well.
But probably not an individual taxi that was wheelchair accessible because the toll reader would have no way to know who your passenger is, right?
Right, right.
And last category, and I think I may have gotten this slightly wrong yesterday or a little bit incomplete anyway, low-income exemptions. I think the part that I omitted yesterday, because I wasn't aware of it yet as the rules were coming out, is that it's different for people who live in the zone than who live out of the zone who want financial hardship exemptions, correct?
That's right. Do you want me to explain a little bit?
Yeah, please.
There's two. So like when the original legislation was passed, you know, they wanted to have something for low-income drivers. So the original congestion pricing law that passed, people who live in the zone below 60th Street, whose annual income is $60,000 or less, will get a tax credit towards the tolls they pay. So they would not be charged. But New Yorkers who live outside of the zone that earn $50,000 a year or less and are enrolled in some sort of income-based assistance program get half off the daytime toll after the first 10 trips in a calendar month.
And there we leave it with our transportation reporter for WNYC and Gothamist Stephen Nesson. Is there a date in June where this takes effect if the lawsuits don't derail it?
The MTA is aiming for June 15th.
And we will talk, assuming this goes into effect over the coming months, about the actual impact on people's lives and also how they define success. What public policy goals will they have achieved once this is in effect for a while? Obviously, a lot more on this to come. Such a big change to driving in Manhattan below 60th Street. Steve, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. So if you were a kid in the 90s or the early 2000s or raised kids during those decades, you're probably familiar with Nickelodeon. The television network, of course, ran numerous hit shows, including All of That, The Amanda Show, Drake and Josh, and iCarly, just to name a few. And the popularity of those shows catapulted their child stars to ultimate levels of fame. Now, decades later, those kids have grown up, and they're telling their stories about abusive conditions that they faced as child actors. The explosive documentary series Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Children's Television, chronicles the exploitative working conditions that women and children experienced while working on Nickelodeon's greatest hits. At least that's what they allege. Much of the series centers on Dan Schneider, the executive producer and screenwriter who created hits at the expense of the children he employed. The documentary says, here's 45 seconds.
In the early 90s, Nickelodeon was kid everything. And you better hope that your house had cable.
Wasn't there to educate you. We were there to have fun, to get slimed, to be entertained.
And this is when Dan Schneider arrives, Nickelodeon's golden boy. He created these shows that were hugely successful for them.
No one had ever really done sketch comedy starring kids for kids.
He launched the careers of child actors who became major stars.
For 20 years, he shaped children's entertainment and culture.
Hey, thank you for being here.
But that marked one of the darkest chapters.
And with us now to talk about this dark chapter of children's television is one of the featured reporters in the docuseries, Kate Taylor, senior correspondent at Business Insider. Kate, thank you for coming on today. Welcome to WNYC.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Start us off by introducing us to Dan Schneider and his role at Nickelodeon. Why was he the central focus of this docuseries?
Dan Schneider is someone who really had a larger-than-life impact and personality at Nickelodeon starting in the late 90s. He kind of became their golden child in a lot of ways, where he got his start as a teenage actor himself on Head of the Class. And then in the 90s, he started as a writer on All That. And then eventually he got a chance to have his own show, The Amanda Show, the first show he created starring Amanda Bynes, who went on to become hugely famous herself. From The Amanda Show, Dan Schneider had this series of hit after hit at Nickelodeon that really helped it compete with the Disney Channel in a way that previously it had not been able to do.
And two of those former child actors featured on Quiet on Set were from the show that you just mentioned, All That. Here's what they had to say about their experience filming the On Air Dares segment of that show. We're hearing here from Kyle Sullivan and Brian Hearn.
The on-air dares were the fear factor of Nickelodeon. We would be standing in these tube chambers. It was like this ominous thing that was deciding, who is it going to be? And then it would be lights, and then it would shine on, you know, all the cast members, and it would stop.
Those were particularly traumatic, and they were sort of designed to be. The whole idea was that you would have to do something scary on camera, and they got pretty scary.
So can you talk more about the on-air dares and the broader working conditions for children on set? If that was happening in front of the camera, what was it like behind the scenes?
The on-air dares are a really good example of something that at the time was seen as kind of normal, where you had kids getting a bunch of sugar dumped on their face, for example, or having to go into a pool full of maggots, things that felt really familiar to Fear Factor at the time. But when you look at this now, especially when you're thinking about the fact that these are children, it raises a lot of issues of, can kids actually consent to undergo these things that are pretty horrific? It also highlights that behind the scenes, these kids were maybe being put in situations that they were not comfortable with, that they felt like they couldn't say no to. Something that came up again and again in our reporting was that child actors and their parents felt like if they pushed back on the demands of Dan Schneider or other people who were running these shows, they felt it would limit their kids' possibilities. And that, for a lot of these families, would have been a huge financial blow.
Listeners, I want to invite some of you in here. Maybe we have former child actors or parents of current child actors or former child actors or people who work in the entertainment industry around child actors listening in. What have you witnessed or experienced while working in entertainment with kids? Is this beyond what's alleged in this documentary about Nickelodeon? Is it safe to be a child actor? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692, or maybe for some of you who grew up with Nickelodeon shows and feel nostalgic when you hear these show titles, or maybe your kids did and, you know, you were lurking and getting some pleasure from them too. And now, as one person who grew up in that generation said to me, my childhood was just shattered when I learned about this. So call or text us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for journalist Kate Taylor. Parents or some sort of guardian were required, I presume are required, to be on set with children. Where was parental supervision in the cases that the docuseries reports on regarding Nickelodeon? And why wasn't that enough to protect kids from this kind of, I guess you'd call it degradation, that the documentary alleges and documents?
I think that some of the most disturbing allegations that we hear in the documentary are instances where parents did try and stick up for their kids, but were basically ignored, where we have one actor who was a kid whose mother tried to say, I'm uncomfortable with this. I don't think that my son should be in these tight outfits. I think that the sketches that he's being put in are really putting him in a racist situation where this child actor was black. His mother said, I think that this is uncomfortable. We shouldn't be doing this. And what ended up happening was he essentially got fired or was not asked back to return to all that. You also see in the situation of Drake Bell, who was one of Nickelodeon's big stars at the time, who went on to co-star in Drake and Josh. His father expressed concerns to production about a dialogue coach who he felt was spending a lot of time with his son, who was, he felt physically kind of a little bit too physically affectionate with his son on set. And he said in the docuseries that his concerns were essentially dismissed.
Let me jump in for just a second, because we have a clip of Drake Bell from the documentary, and you'll tell me if this is exactly what you're describing here. Here's Drake Bell talking about this dialogue coach named Brian Peck, who worked on numerous Nickelodeon and Disney Channel shows.
The abuse was extensive. And it got pretty brutal. Why don't you do this?
Yeah.
Why don't you think of the worst stuff that someone can do to somebody as a sexual assault, and that'll answer your question.
Whoa. And was that new, a revelation from Drake?
Yes, Drake had never spoken about this publicly before. Drake, it's really, really heartbreaking to think about where the abuse that he was suffering as a 15-year-old was juxtaposed with this really wild professional success. So he speaks out in the docuseries about why this is the first time he is talking about this. And a lot of that is because he went forward in this criminal case as a John Doe because he was very concerned about what the career repercussions would be if he came forward as the survivor of sexual abuse at the hands of this dialogue coach, Brian Peck.
The series gets so specific, it names names. Their dialogue coach, Brian Peck, Dan Schneider, we talked about before. And we have to say these are very serious allegations against individuals. Have they responded?
Brian Peck pleaded no contest at the time when this case was going forward, when Drake was still anonymous. He has not responded to our request for comment. But Dan Schneider, who is the person behind a lot of these shows, who the docuseries lays out these allegations related mostly to a toxic workplace environment and putting child actors in uncomfortable situations, has responded in a nearly 20-minute long YouTube video.
And how much in that YouTube video, which I haven't seen, I presume you have, did he defend himself? How much did he apologize? How would you describe it?
The YouTube video is really interesting because in some cases he does confirm a lot of our reporting about things we heard. And in some cases he apologizes for these things, such as expecting or asking people who worked for him, especially women, to give him massages. In other cases, he denies that he was responsible for things. So in the example that we provide of two female writers on the Amanda Show were expected to split a salary, he says in the video, essentially, that was not his decision. So it was a mix of both saying and confirming that he was responsible for some things and in some cases apologizing for those things and denying responsibility for other things.
Let's take some phone calls from people calling in with child actor experiences. Michael in Miami, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for making
it. Can you
hear me? Yep.
I've worked on Broadway shows and on set with kids for years and years, 10 years on different productions with Disney and other major producers. I have not witnessed what she's talking about in the form of direct abuse, but I have no doubt that it's very possible. Just the way the power structure exists in that system and how often the parents are separated from the kids with the kid being overseen by some sort of adult minder or what they call them wranglers. But in the Broadway space, the big thing that I've seen is that transition from kid actor to adult actor, whether there's not counting abuse in any way, but the fact that these kids are trained to be kids. They are brought in because they're cute or they're brought in because they have a certain personality trait. And then suddenly they move into being an adult actor and suddenly they're not getting roles. They're not getting auditions because their entire world and their entire life has been focused on this one skill set, which doesn't actually help them to be an adult actor. And I see a lot of depression. I see a lot of spiraling of these kids and the parents have great intentions. They wanna have the best opportunities for these kids, but I don't think they realize that what they're training these kids to do don't necessarily support them after they are no longer a kid.
So based on that observation, do you think there's no way to be a child actor and transition to adulthood, in a psychologically sound way? Or are there ways that are sometimes employed in best practices?
I have a lot of parents who, just because of my experience in the business, say, hey, is this a good idea for my kid to be in the show? And I have two kids myself who are both wanting to be performers. I didn't allow them to go into professional acting as kids. I said, if you want to do that after you're in high school and you know who you are, I don't think there's a healthy journey. I mean, I think there's possibilities. I mean, we can thread the needle in many ways, but I think the world is counted against you. I think there's too many obstacles. And I think that the kid mindset is so based on pleasing other people that suddenly they can't please people at all. It's such an adult profession is so independent, while a kid profession is so reliant on adults.
Michael, we really appreciate your call and telling us about your experience and what this looked like to you in the case of so many children. And Kate Taylor, senior correspondent at Business Insider, I mean, that's such a even more global critique than anything we see in these stories of abuse in the documentary Quiet on Set. Have you thought about it at that level?
Completely. And I think that that's something that even before Quiet on Set, when I was first starting my reporting on kind of Dan Schneider back in 2022, when I first wrote an article on this, it's hard to kind of realize a lot of these issues are universal to children working in entertainment, while also trying to think about how can we produce results and how can we kind of pinpoint exact issues that happened, and how universal do you want to be versus how specific do you want to be to find specific people who might have been really not only not helping the environment, but making the environment worse and worse than maybe the wider critique of the space could be. So I think it's really interesting. And I think it's also, when we consider what we want to take away from the documentary, a lot of what I want people to take away is to think about, how do we not have another documentary like this in 20 years, talking about things like child influencers or kids who are on TV shows today? How do we apply these lessons and fix things for kids who are kids right now, so we don't have to look back on this in 20 years and question why we weren't making changes?
How do we?
Oh, sorry, what was that?
How do we?
I think it's really difficult. I think that something I've thought about a lot is the idea of more regulation and kind of creating better laws to protect. I mean, when we think about kids working in other industries, we don't tolerate child labor. I think that having this be something that is a kid's entire life, and to have a child be a primary breadwinner, often is a first step in creating a really dangerous environment. I think that it's something that I would also really like other former child actors to be taking the lead on when they think about, how could I have been supported better? And for the parents, something that I've thought about a lot is, not all these parents have a great understanding of the business, how to keep their kids safe, how to think about the financials, how to have their kid go from a child, a minor, to an adult themselves, and how they can set them on the best track for that in a way that they feel like they are financially stable and they can leave this industry or stay in this industry without a huge expectation that if they do not want to do this anymore, it could put their family in debt in a very real way.
Melinda on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in, Melinda.
Hi, Brian. My kids did a lot of film and TV work when they were little. We were hoping to jumpstart the college fund. My husband and I had both worked in professional theater, so we sort of had a good sense for what we were getting into. And I did have a situation on a Nickelodeon shoot where my son was asked to do something he wasn't comfortable with, and we didn't do it. But my question is, these parents that got into these bad situations with their kids and got in so deep, where was their union rep? All of these kids had to be SAG members to do this work. So where was the union rep, and why weren't they reaching out to them? Those were the people that were there to advocate for you and sort of wear the bad hat, you know, and be the person who would speak up. So where were they? Why weren't they in the mix?
It's a great question, and we got a text from a listener who said Nickelodeon was non-union in those days. So can you shed some light, Kate?
I think that that was part of it, that I don't believe all of these kids would have been covered by the union. But more than that, I think that your example is actually really helpful, where I think that a lot of the kids who had the hardest time who we spoke with, their parents are not people who have any background in show business, who don't necessarily know who to go to for help, where we heard from people who parents would go to their agents, or to be specific, their child's agents. And these are the people who normally should be like, if you're uncomfortable, like, let's connect you to the union rep, let's connect you to legal representation, let's kind of fix this situation for you. And for people who don't have background in show business, don't know kind of how these structures are supposed to work, when the agents say, listen, this is how it works, like, we have to kind of let this go, like, you want to not get a reputation for being difficult, these parents can hear that and say, okay, well, I guess that's just how it works. And, like, I don't have any information about the structures in place here.
And here's another clip, one more clip from the documentary. This is a montage. And sort of from a viewer's standpoint, many people who enjoyed shows like iCarly and Victorious are looking back at some of the scenes in those shows and now noticing deeply inappropriate jokes sort of hidden in plain sight. Here's what some former staff members had to say about some of those scenes.
Kids show should be exactly what it is, a kids show. And sometimes there were scenes where there was a prop that was like...
What's he doing?
That could be a sexual innuendo.
Those are good ones.
Dan went overboard and just zoomed in too often on the feet.
Wow, they're really soft.
Zoomed in too often on the tongue licking things, or something that just went too far.
Was anyone able to say anything, or was that like...
Oh, no. No, it's Dan's baby.
Yeah, so this brings up the caller Melinda's question again, doesn't it? Who was there to say anything?
And I think that for Dan Schneider shows, that was part of the reason that he became a real focus of this, is because based on the people we spoke with, many people felt that Schneider was both very uniquely powerful at Nickelodeon, where he was able to kind of get away with jokes that other showrunners might not be able to get past standards. And his jokes were pretty uniquely bizarre. And looking back at them now, I think that we can say many feel pretty specifically sexual.
I want to acknowledge before we run out of time that while we've been talking overwhelmingly about child actors in the context of this documentary, it wasn't just the children who suffered. In the series, we meet women who worked as writers for The Amanda Show. Would you just tell that story a little bit?
Yeah, so The Amanda Show was the first show that Dan Schneider created for Nickelodeon. And because it's starring a young Amanda Bynes, it's something that I would have imagined would have had kind of some women in the writer's room, and that you would really be encouraging women to kind of be involved in the creation of this. In fact, the two writers who worked on the first season of Amanda Show described their experience as incredibly disturbing, where they were expected to give Dan massages, they were expected to kind of humiliate themselves in front of the rest of the writer's room, and they had to split a salary, despite not having worked together previously. In the end, after a season, you have one of the writers file a complaint saying that this is a toxic workplace and that she faced sexism at work, due in large part because of Schneider. And something that really surprised me when I first uncovered this was that even though this was so early on in Dan Schneider's career at Nickelodeon, it does not seem to have slowed down his rise to power at all at the network.
You know what? We're going to close with a former child actor calling in to say that he had a good experience as a child actor, but interestingly in a different context. Michael in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, thanks for fitting me into the segment. I just wanted to say, first of all, I wanted to say thank you to the people who did the documentary. I did watch Quiet on the Set, and I found it quite disturbing. And I'll just say that. I thought it was well done, and thank you. But I had an experience on Sesame Street in the early years of Sesame Street, and it wasn't until I watched Quiet on the Set and even heard this segment that I realized we had no union rep, there was no adult supervision, my parents never visited the studio, but we were treated beautifully. And it was union wages, everybody on that show, Mr. Hooper, Will Lee, Gordon, Matt Robinson, all the adults were wonderful around us. They were as wonderful in real life as they seemed when we were kids. And it was great.
Go so public broadcasting.
Yeah, so I mean, there are other models, like not-for-profit models, that should be taken into consideration when we're looking at the things that happen in for-profit models.
Thank you so much for that story. Any contrast that you would leave us with? I don't know if you've reported on anything like that, Kate.
I haven't, but I think that is something, even at Nickelodeon, some of the former child actors who I spoke with said, I look back at this as a generally positive experience. And some of them I reached out to again after they watched the documentary, and they said, I'm revisiting this with new eyes now. So I think that it can be easy to see these things as black and white. But I hope everyone walks away knowing that a lot of former child actors see things in shades of gray. And what I hope we take from this is kind of thinking about how we can make everyone safer and look to shows that have done that successfully.
Kate Taylor, senior correspondent at Business Insider, and a featured reporter in the new docuseries, Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Children's Television. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Brian Litter on WNYC. And let's end the show with some language fun with Anne Curzan, a professor of English language and literature, linguistics, and education at the University of Michigan. She has a new book just out today called Says Who? A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. Yes, she wrote funner, and we'll explain why that sounds wrong and who decides these things anyway. Welcome, Professor Curzan. Welcome to WNYC. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Brian, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
And before we get to funner and open up the phones for listener participation here, let's talk about your overall approach to what's right and wrong with language usage. Instead of telling us what's right and wrong, like no double negatives, no irregardless, no ain't, you describe what you call a struggle between gramandos and wordies. So explain who those two groups are.
Sure. The word gramando, which I think is a great one, I want to credit Lizzie Skernick, who publicized this word in the New York Times Magazine in the section, That Should Be a Word. And it's used to describe someone who is constantly correcting other people's grammar. In writing the book, I came to realize that I think every single one of us has a little inner gramando in our head. That inner gramando may have a really big, loud microphone or a smaller microphone, but it's there. And when we hear new bits of language or unfamiliar language that surprises us, that inner gramando may perk up and say, what's that? I don't like that. And in the book, I'm encouraging us to have some conversations with our inner gramando about whether that's the right response, because we also have in our head an inner wordy. Humans enjoy language. I don't know how many of our listeners enjoy playing Wordle in the morning or spelling bee, or maybe they like to pun, play Scrabble. We enjoy language. We're curious about language. And I think sometimes the way that we have learned grammar in school can take the fun out of it. And what I'm trying to do is bring the fun back in, give people more information so that our wordy and our gramando can have these conversations about, is that a useful rule? Says who? Who said that's a rule? Do I need to follow it in speech and writing? And it makes us really savvy speakers and writers when we can have those conversations.
And so that's the title of the book, Says Who, by University of Michigan Professor Anne Curzan. And listeners, are you more a gramando or a wordy? Do you have a pet peeve with language usage? Does more unique drive you bonkers? Irregardless, anyone, do these literally, people hate literally, make you cranky? Hopefully, another one, my guest Anne Curzan can shed some light on what's going on with the way we use and police language. Call or text us at 212-433-WNYC, you gramandos and you wordies, 212-433-9692. Again, you can call or text with a question, a pet peeve, the best sentence you ever wrote, whatever. So I guess the gramando in somebody might balk at funner in the title of the book, the subtitle, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. And I'm sure you intended that, but why?
I did. I put it in the title for a couple of reasons. One is to suggest that this book, while it's a usage guide, might be a little bit irreverent about some of those rules that we learned. And second, I knew that some people would pick it up with funner in the title and say, what is going on here? Who is this English professor who would ever put funner in the title of a usage guide? There's a really good story behind this word. I study the history of the English language, which means I get to look at how words change over time and how our attitudes about them change over time. And fun, for much of its life in English, was a noun. That means that if we said that party was fun, fun was functioning there like the noun chaos. That party was chaos. But when kids heard that, you can imagine how they might reinterpret that as an adjective. That party was boring, that party was great, that party was fun. And in the 20th century, we started to see that adjective use come in. Kids reinterpreted it. And interestingly, in the 20th century, there were usage guides that were very cranky about fun as an adjective. They said, you should just not use that as an adjective. You shouldn't say a fun party. We've gotten over that, so now we allow fun to be an adjective. What we're seeing now is that kids are trying to make fun as an adjective behave like other one-syllable adjectives. If we think about tall, taller, tallest, wide, wider, widest, you can see where I'm going.
Fun, funner, funnest.
Fun, funner, funnest. And that's what kids will do because they figure out the pattern. And then some adult authority figure says, ugh, don't say that. Funner is terrible. And the kid then stores that away as an exception. I think what may happen here is that many adults don't have quite as strong a reaction to funnest as they do to funner. And funnest has shown up in some advertising campaigns in a playful way. I would guess, I may not live long enough to see it, that funnest will come in first into standard usage, and then funner will scoot in on its coattails.
So before we get off fun, funner, funnest, is there a reason that the superlative, the funnest, would sound more acceptable to people than funner, earlier than funner?
It's a great question. I don't know the answer. One possibility is that the people have gone more grammando on funner, and funnest has not been as affected. It doesn't come up as the example as often, but that's just a guess on why funnest doesn't sound as wrong to people.
Well, this is definitely the funnest segment we've done on the show today. And if you're ready to talk to another English teacher, here's Anthony in Nutley, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Anthony.
Yes. Hi, Brian. I'm Corzin. Love the show. This is very interesting. I can't wait to see the book. I'm an English teacher. I teach English as a second language. I've been doing it for over 20 years. And I really have to impress upon my students the difference between the grammando and the wordies, because English with its hybrid vigor, I mean, I don't know nothing. You know, the sound of that is a much stronger expression than I don't know anything. And nouns used as adjectives, flower shop, et cetera, et cetera. And my peeve with English, and I've gotten these all off the radio, I'm not going to read them to you, but it's no agreement between subject and verb. And this is a very, very common error, and I hear it all the time on classy radio stations like yourself. not on your show, though.
What's an example? So what do you mean no agreement between? You have one that jumps out at you?
Oh, I have a couple. One of the claims that were decided, every one of the parking garages have to undergo inspection. A steady stream of tourists walk up to the gate. One of my favorite choreographers are...
Right. And Anthony, I'm going to leave it there. So those are all examples of the singular or the plural conjugation of the verb, right? Anne?
Yes, they are. And it is true that when we're processing in real time, we will sometimes have a verb that might agree with the noun that is closest to it, which I heard in some of the examples that we just got. One of the claims were where technically the verb agrees with one, but claims is sitting right next to it, which can catch us. We're trying to do a lot of work when we're speaking on the fly. It's also true that some of this territory is tricky. You can take some nouns like the jury, and it depends whether you're an American English speaker or a British English speaker as to whether that takes a singular verb or a plural verb. There are also pronouns that can take both. So if we think about an expression such as either cake or cookies is fine, are fine. Are we talking about the cake or the cookies?
Right.
And one of the rules you'll see in usage guides is a proximity rule, which is go with the noun closest. So either the cake or cookies are, but either the cookies or the cake is.
Really?
Depends on the order of the nouns.
And if you say either one, then it is. Either one is fine.
Mm-hmm. So it's I understand the concern when we hear something and we say, oh, I don't think that's right. One thing is to recognize that speaking in real time, we will sometimes get caught on a more complicated grammatical construction. The other is that some of these constructions where you have a singular pronoun, one, either, each, and followed by a plural noun, those are tricky, and sometimes you should usage guides don't totally agree about what is quote-unquote correct.
Mike in San Francisco is calling as a self-identified Gramando. Mike, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, as I was telling your screen, I'm a real Gramando, and every time I hear these two phrases, I just kind of wince inside. I don't say anything, but it really bugs me. And I've gotten my kids in the habit, so they know not to do these things. One is nauseous. I hear it used out of context all the time when it should be nauseated. You know, that cake made me nauseous. That cake made me nauseated. The cake itself is nauseous. You get it? So that's one thing. The other one is when people say, before she died, she told me, or before she died, she did this. I'm like, well, duh, you know, it's unnecessary. So those are my two little pet peeves, and I'll sign off.
She was obviously alive if she did it. Okay, thank you very much. Should I just go on? Do you want to comment on those, or I could just go on to another one? But go ahead,
Anne. I'll do a quick comment about nauseous and nauseated. I'm afraid that you're probably going to lose this one. At this point, for many of us, nauseous means nauseated. So we can say, I feel nauseous. You'll find it all over edited prose. My partner, who's a medical doctor, still continues to use nauseated in that context and feels very strongly about it. But I have told him that he's going to lose. The rest of us who have changed the meaning of that word will win. And one note here is that I think often change in word meaning historically seems really interesting to us. People will say to me, you mean nice used to mean silly and lollygag meant fool around in the kissing sense? That's so interesting. But then when the change is happening all around us, as with nauseous, it can feel more worrisome.
Sarah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay, great. I'm definitely a Gramando. My husband gets so angry at me about it all the time. I should keep my mouth shut more often. But I can't stand two things. The word impactful, because I think it was made up. Like, I don't think it's an actual word. And when people use the word myself incorrectly, and instead they should just say me, but it's as if they're saying myself because they think it sounds, you know, smarter. So those are my two things.
Thank you. How about impactful? That's a classic.
Well, what I love about impactful is that it is also one of my peeves. And I'm honest about the fact that I'm trained as a linguist. I study the history of the language, but I still have an inner Gramando. I manage to keep it pretty quiet much of the time, but my Gramando does not like the word impactful. Somehow I find it aesthetically displeasing, but I have no good grounds for this. The word impactful is completely well-formed. It's just like meaningful or hopeful.
Full of impact.
full of impact. And it's relatively new, which is why many of us are noticing it. But I can feel myself starting to get over it. I find myself saying things like, that change is going to be very, and I realize I'm headed straight toward impactful. I often take a right turn and say significant, but I'm clearly getting over it.
What's another one of yours?
Of my peeves?
Uh-huh.
I found myself a few months ago getting cranky about what I consider to be a business jargon term, which is double click. I have colleagues here at the business school who use this as a verb to mean to dig deeper into or dive into. And I was in presentations where someone would have a slide with, for example, 3 points on it, and then they would say, let's double click on that first one. And that was the way they would transition to the next slide. And I thought, oh, that is so jargony. I can't believe this. And I went home. Again, I usually don't share these, but somehow over dinner, I was sharing with my partner this whole peeve about double click. And he just looked at me and said, I actually think it's quite clever. And the nice thing was that then my inner wordy could speak up and say, of course it is. It's actually playful and rather delightful. And I don't use double click yet. And I would want to say to listeners, you always have the option of opting out. You can decide you don't like impactful and decide not to use it. But that's different from correcting other people on it. And I think a lot about that as an English professor who is working with students on their writing.
And double click is so Windows centric. I use an iPad. All I have to do is touch a screen. We've gotten calls from a number of Gramandos, and I'll say most of the people calling in are identifying themselves as Gramandos, and they really want to talk about the words or phrases that drive them crazy. But we have one person calling, Nick from Brooklyn, who's identifying as a wordy. So, Nick, you're on WNYC. Go for it.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm definitely more of a wordy than a Gramando, and I tend to get bothered by things that are correct that I feel should be incorrect. And one of those things was a running argument I used to have with my father-in-law about when you would compare yourself to somebody else or something else. For instance, if I were to say, he is smarter than I, that is the correct way to say it, because smarter than I am. And I always thought that was ridiculously awkward. And it should be smarter than me, because we're talking about someone else and me. So
I love that example. Because part of what we're hearing here is that exactly, Nick, as some of the things that we've learned are correct at this point, don't sound right. I think about many contexts in which, for example, whom, which is really trying to die, if we would just let it die.
Yeah.
But whom can sound too formal. It can sound stuffy. So while technically it might be the grammatically correct choice, and I'm using scare quotes around correct, in context, whom may not feel right. I grew up with a mother who made us answer the phone, this is she speaking. And I was taught he's taller than I. But we also know that in other languages, you would say, for example, it's me, c'est moi in French. And it is fine to say that in English. You don't need to say it is I. You can say it's me.
We've got 45 seconds left in the show. Listener texts. Just sit back, relax, and watch the language change with the culture. It's way more fun than fighting it. But they use the word culture, and the thing we haven't talked about yet is cultural differences within American English. Black English, call it whatever you want to call it, where, you know, it can be kind of, I don't know, at worst racist, at least kind of in your own bubble to pass judgment on certain things.
I think a really important thing to remember here is that diversity in language is part of the diversity of us. And that we're a diverse culture, and we're going to see a lot of diversity in language. All varieties of English are systematic. One of them got standardized. All the rest are systematic. And language is a key part of who we are and who our communities are. And that's why I'm hoping people can enjoy language more and take a more inclusive, kinder approach to it.
And Curzon's book is called Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. Thanks so much. This was funner than anything else we did today.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.